Good afternoon, and welcome to Real Talk. Real Talk is the show that comes to you every Tuesday at noon. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, and this is the show that seeks to answer questions large and small. Today's question is, are dogs better police than humans? Here to answer that question with us is Rachel Rose. She is the Poet Laureate of Vancouver, British Columbia. Recently a fellow at the University of Iowa's International Writing Program, Rachel has won awards for her poetry, her fiction, and her nonfiction, including a 2014 and 2016 Pushcart Prize. She's published work in journals and anthologies in Canada and the U.S., and she is the winner of the Peterson Memorial Prize for poetry and the Bronwyn Wallace Award for fiction. But today we're going to talk to her about a nonfiction book that she has written, titled The Dog Lover Unit, Lessons in Courage from the World's Canine Cops. Rachel, welcome to Real Talk.
Oh, thank you so much. It's really a delight to have a chance to talk about my book today.
My first question, of course, is, as a poet, what is it that motivated you to write about canine cops?
Yeah, well, it was quite a departure, so you're not the first person to ask
I'm sure.
That. And I've joked that this book could also be called When Poets Go Rogue, because it was really so out of character for me as a poet and a mom of three kids to be hitting the road with these really tough cops and their amazing dogs who are fighting dogs, right? And incredibly well-trained, but trained to do interventions. And so the short answer is I got curious, and I heard from my partner, who's a police doctor, some of what the canine teams were capable of doing, and I was absolutely intrigued. And animals have always had such an important role in my own life growing up, and I've always found that bond to be profound. And so I thought, well, what would it be like if you depend on your dog to save your own life, and so you have that bond, but you're also with them 24/7, and you also depend on them to protect you. So that was a big part of it.
Yeah. What did you learn that you mentioned the things that these dogs are capable of, such as what?
Well, you know, it's hard even to sum it up because I learned so much. I started with dogs in the RCMP, that's the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and it's a federal policing, like the FBI, I guess, a federal police force. And the dogs there, they're all German Shepherds, they're all purpose-bred, and they're really capable of everything that a dog can do. So they do intervention, they'll apprehend suspects, they also can track for missing persons, and search for them, and they can do bomb and drug detection, and really they're trained to do such a variety of things. So that was fascinating. And different departments, like when I was in London, they have very specialized dogs, and Paris too, so their dogs, they'll have maybe English Spaniels to do sniffing for drugs and for bombs and, you know, clearing the Queen's chambers. One of the dogs I met, that was her job was to check before the Queen came into her chambers that everything was in order. And so they use these beautiful, vigorous English Spaniels for that. And then they'll have shepherds to do apprehension and bite work if necessary. So they'll have their cars with the kennels in the back divided for each dog. And they'll have, you know, four or five dogs in a home. So that was quite neat, too.
So what you're saying is these are police officers in Britain who might have four or five dogs, each with a different specialty?
Well, no, they'll have usually two dogs, but they'll have one in training. And one of the most wonderful things in the Metropolitan Police Force was the number of husband and wife police teams that I met. So that's why there would be four or five dogs, because the wife would have her dogs, the husband would have his dogs. There was one wonderful moment that I recount in the book where we were stuck in traffic, and I was with a police officer named Russell Turner and his two dogs, and we'd just done a search, and I saw these two beautiful mounted police officers on these big dark horses up ahead of us, and I rolled down my window because I love horses, and I was watching them, and Russell Turner said, "I think that's my wife. I think that's Liz." And it was indeed his wife. And so that was just such a neat moment, you know, real animal lovers in that unit.
What did you find in your you spent time with canine police and their partners, their human partners, in four different countries, the United States, Canada, Britain, and France. What did you find that surprised you in each of these places? Or can you tell us what those distinctions might be from nation
yes.
to nation?
Yes, well, there were a lot of surprises. So I went in, you know, pretty ignorant, I think, about what police do, just really what I'd gathered from the papers and social media. And each police force, I think, really faces different issues in terms of who they're policing and what they're dealing with. And each one really also acts autonomously, so it can be quite different from one state to another in the U.S. or one country to another. But what surprised me, I think, was how similar the canine officers' personalities were, whether they were in Paris or in California. So they really, really seem to have a type who's drawn to that kind of work.
And how would you describe that type?
So they are people who cannot sit behind a desk and do paperwork. They're really sort of outdoors people. They love adventures. They are the, you know, where many people would have a sort of response to danger, like running away, they sort of rush in. So they have a different threshold in terms of adrenaline and fear, and they are really able to be calm in dangerous situations and go in and actually find it interesting to take those risky assignments. And so that was pretty cool to see just what they were capable of and how similar they were, despite, you know, language and cultural differences. Mm. And then the bond that they have with their animals was very similar across the board, that they spend all their time with their animals, that they talk to them, that they just, you know, it's a hard job. There's a lot of misconceptions, I think, about the police and what they do, and their dogs don't judge them, and they have unconditional support and love for them. And so that was really great to be around that kind of energy and that kind of grit. And, yeah, people who are not afraid and people who just are actively trained to keep fighting through a difficult situation. Yeah.
I wonder, and you may not have been able to discern this, but a lot of police officers who are not canine officers tend to become jaded and perverted in some ways. Would you say that their work with canines softens that police officer's view of the world at all?
Hmm. That is an interesting question. I don't think that I would say it softens their view of the world, because I think that police officers see people at their worst, on often the worst days of their lives, mm-hmm. and doing the worst things you can imagine to each other. But I would say that it is a protective, psychologically protective thing, that they have this other world, that they have their animals, that they have each other, and that they're out training with their dogs every single day, because you never take time off to do that, and that they're out, you know, in the brush or in the wilderness working their dogs, you know, in the snow at midnight, or tracking out in beautiful scenery, that they are able to do that. Yeah, I think it's extremely protective of, and just gives them something else besides what they might see on the job. So it's definitely a good thing.
Yeah, it sounds like a strengthening thing in that bond. Well, those of us who have had pets, particularly dogs, can begin to understand that sort of bond. I'm curious how they're able to find dogs or puppies that are going to match their sense of adventure and courage? How do they, I mean, how do they know they've got one that's going to go with them and not going to back off and say, but you take care of this?
Oh, well, that is a very good question, and that actually ties into what you asked earlier about differences between police forces.
Hmm.
So here's something that I found surprising, because I had thought, and I'm an American and Canadian, I had thought that in the States, with its sort of reputation for law and order, there would be a lot of funding for law enforcement. And in fact, in a lot of the places I went, that wasn't necessarily the case, and they depended on private donations to get their dogs. And so that was a surprise for me.
Wow.
They didn't have necessarily the resources that they needed, or they would depend on donations. Whereas in Canada, we have all of our dogs purpose-bred at Innisfail, and the training is really state-of-the-art, and the funding is there, and a lot of the dogs, so they start testing them at 6 weeks, and a lot of them don't make it, even though these are, you know, the best breeding stock that there is. Some of them are great dogs in certain areas like tracking, but they just don't have the aggression when it's needed. So a lot of them will fail out, and then they'll do other things. They might use that tracking skill to become search and rescue dogs or in some other area. But they really have to test them. And, you know, and everywhere they have the training to see if the dog has what it takes and if it will do what's needed. One thing I want to also comment on is in Paris, again, there's a lack of funding, and many of their dogs, almost all, are from high-kill shelters. They're rescue dogs.
Oh.
So they have this agreement with the shelters that if there's a dog that somebody's given up or abandoned and it has potential and it looks like it's smart and capable and willing to be trained, the shelters call, the police pick them up, and rehabilitate them. And so I met so many of these dogs that were really about to be put down, about to, you know, have that last trip to the needle, and they had been successfully made the transition to amazing police dogs. So that was just great to see.
That's so impressive, and it makes me wonder about age. Is there an optimum age for these dogs, or is there a 5 or 6 year old dog in a pound sitting somewhere that might be perfect for this sort of work?
So I think 5 or 6 would be pushing it, because a lot of them retire at 7 or 8. So of course there are dogs in pounds that would be fantastic if they were given a chance. And I think it's wonderful to see that there are programs out there that are finding police dogs, or finding, you know, working dogs who can do other jobs. I just did an interview with some cadaver dog teams. And
mm-hmm.
So there are many, many capable dogs of all breeds out there, but I think you want to get a dog on the younger side for sure. A year or two is really ideal.
You mentioned the distinctions among the different countries and their police forces, and one of them was funding. Does that mean that in Canada the funding is greater than it is in the U.S.? Does that then make the Canadian police forces more reliant on dogs than perhaps U.S. police forces might be? In other words, do the Canadian law enforcement groups use dogs more than American police?
Well, those are both good questions. So I should say I can't speak for the U.S. as a whole, because each state and each department has really different funding, and it's run in very different ways. So I don't think it's quite a fair comparison, because, the RCMP is a federal force, and then I was looking at individual state police departments. Who didn't have the same kind of funding. But I'm sure some of them do. I think it really just depends. And who uses police dogs more? I just don't know. I know that they're such a big part of policing here. And they, you know, because Canada is such a massive country with territories where there are not a lot of people, dogs that can track and search and be out there in the brush for 48 hours at a time, That's an essential service that we have, but I think dogs are pretty widely used in the States as well. That's certainly my impression, and there seem to be more and more need for them and uses for them.
You're listening to Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, and I am fortunate to be speaking with Rachel Rose, author of The Dog Lover Unit, Lessons in Courage from the World's Canine Cops. And I can do this thanks to Windermere Vashon Realty for making all our community information programming and our emergency alert service possible. Rachel, in your book, you write about the challenges that these canine-human teams face on a daily basis. Can you give us some examples of, you rode along with these teams in four different countries. What did you observe in terms of challenges that some of them had to meet?
I wonder if I couldn't read you a short excerpt about some of my time in Paris. Would now be a good time?
That would be great, yeah. That would
okay,
be
because I think some of the challenges that they faced were profound. So I'll just read you a little bit about so I was in the Brigade Cynophile, and that's the direct translation of that into English is the Dog Lover Unit, the Brigade Cynophile. Uh-huh. That's just outside of Paris. And I was with Commandant Heritier, and I'll just read a little bit about what I saw and observed there. Commandant Heritier introduces me to another member of the brigade. He gives me only his initial, J., and instructs me not to photograph his face unmasked. Jay is at too much risk. As a member of the BRI, the Brigade SWAT team, Jay was called to duty on November 13th. Jay has a long, noble face, like a portrait of an ancient saint, with deep-set black eyes and a black beard splashed with silver on each side. Rocky, the dog that was being bandaged earlier, is Jay's dog. Bataclan was not my first intervention with Rocky, says Jay. We were also working together with the SWAT team during the Porte de Vincennes attacks at the Jewish market. We were part of the final assault and rescue of the hostages. The Porte de Vincennes terrorist attacks on January 9, 2015, occurred in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo murders 2 days earlier and left 4 Jewish hostages dead. Individuals within the market, both Jewish and Muslim, resisted heroically, even at the cost of their own lives, and a number of lives were spared because of their actions. Jay and Rocky are part of a battle-seasoned anti-terrorist intervention team. What was your feeling when you were going in there, I ask. For Bataclan, it was a very particular feeling. I didn't know I was going into that place. It was so exceptional, so out of the ordinary. In the days after, it wasn't images that came, but really a feeling of strangeness, as if this is not possible. Intellectually, it's bizarre. How could this have happened? It must be so difficult for you, and for your family, too, I say. At the beginning, says Jay, I didn't tell my family what I did. For my wife, there's an anguish. She knows what I do. We live directly in the line of danger. The risk is continual. After the 13th November attacks, was the training different? Yes. Before, we weren't prepared to intervene in mass killings. We train differently now. How do you find the courage to do what you do, I ask? To serve, to be of service. There have to be people who fight these things. We have to have people to do it. Jay pauses. That's a good question. He pauses again. In fact, it's better not to think too much about it. This is my cue to change the subject. Tell me about Rocky, I say. Jay smiles for the first time in our interview. His whole face is transformed, talking about his dog. Rocky? We also call him Scrat from the movie Ice Age because Rocky is funny like this character. Do you know that movie? Yes. Rocky. He listens well, he works well, but he's a bit funny. If Rocky, a.k.a. Scrat, has a funny side, it's one he shares only with Jay. The dog I see is a fighter through and through. Often it's only their handlers who see the true personalities of their dogs. I see only the public face. So I think I'll stop there, but that gives you a sense of what they face and how difficult it is and how much they depend on the bond that they have with their dogs to kind of get them through.
That is actually mesmerizing. And I'm listening to that and thinking, I have two dogs who freak out at loud noises.
Right.
How do they train these dogs to remain calm in the worst of situations?
You know, I think I was underground doing some of the terrorist attack preparation training outside Paris. And, you know, it's step by step. It's repeating. It's rewarding. These are intelligent dogs. They can learn. I have a Maltipoo. She would never make it. She's not that kind of dog. She has other qualities. But these are dogs who really, when they're working with their handlers, you get the sense that they know exactly what's being asked, and they know how to do it. And I mean, there are techniques that they use to get the dogs in when they'll go in first into a barred room, or have to go and find out what's going on. And they know what they need to do, and they've been trained step by step and systematically and repeatedly, so that they're able to do it when they need to.
And that it's incredibly mysterious to me. It's almost as though it's almost as though there's a mental emotional bond that that helps these dogs to intuit what their next step should be, because it's got to require some kind of reasoning when they're walking into a criminal situation or a potential bomb situation.
You know, I think they're trained through love and reward and lots of praise, and they really want to please. So another time I was in this abandoned school, and I was watching an experienced handler getting all of the new dogs to drop down into this pit. And for them, I describe it in the book, but for them it was terrifying because they can't see depth. It was dark down there, and basically their dads, their handlers, are asking them to, you know, drop into the abyss. And almost all of them did it, and a lot of them struggled, a lot of them were scared, and they do it out of trust, you know. And it was very interesting to see how the handlers, they have to be so patient and so solid in themselves to coax these dogs to do this very terrifying thing. They can't force them, because you don't want to have your dog do it out of fear or to be compelled. You want them to go in because it's what you ask them to do. And so for people who are police dog handlers who tend to, you know, maybe not be the most patient people in the world, to be people who, have a lot of adrenaline, have a lot of drive themselves, for them to have to just slow right down and spend 15 or 20 minutes getting the dogs used to dropping into these pits was really interesting for me to see. And of course I thought, well, could my dog do this? But it also shifted my sort of opinion, because I had thought, well, these poor dogs, they're out there doing these really tough things and their lives must be hard. And I wondered if I felt sorry for them. But after, I felt much more sorry for my dog, who doesn't really have jobs and doesn't have that kind of purpose and doesn't get to be out all day and all night with me. And, you know, she has a few little jobs. She cuddles the kids and hangs out on our couch, but it's not the same thing.
Yeah, I know. I have a dog trainer friend who continually reminds me that dogs are much happier when they have jobs, when they have purpose. And
I've been trying to work some of that in, just getting her to seek and find the kids in different parts of the house, and she loves it. I think they all need work, but I really feel like the police dogs that I met took pride in their jobs and just loved to please their handlers, and they couldn't do what they needed if they didn't have that bond built on love and trust. So
I believe it's true that dogs are the only animals that have chosen to be with humans, that have chosen to be, if you will, domesticated. Makes me sometimes wonder how smart they are, but...
Well, I'm just grateful that they...
They're willing to put up with us.
Yes.
How did you get these police departments in Britain, Canada, France, and the U.S. to allow you to ride along with them?
Well, That was hard. So as I mentioned, my partner is a police doctor, mm-hmm. and so I thought they might give me a chance, but it took months of calling, and really, I'd almost given up. I called, I wrote letters, I said, please let me have a chance to ride, this is what I want to do, and I really was not getting anywhere. And then there was one officer who I reached out to. He's in the book, Daryl Moores, and he really gave me a chance, and he took me out and introduced me to some other people after I finally got permission from the RCMP to do one, and he really connected me. And then, you know, it got easier and easier, and it was really tough at first because I wasn't a journalist, I wasn't a tough guy, I was running after these very fit teams, and it was hard on all levels. But once I had some connections, other police forces who were proud of what they were doing would let me go, and they'd welcome me, actually. So people who wanted the public to see what they're doing and understand what they were doing, word spread. And actually, it was hard for me to stop because I really would have liked to do more places in the States. I really would have loved to go to Mexico and to Japan. And I heard in Japan that they use poodles for some police dog work, and I thought, oh my gosh, I'd love to go there and find out more about that. But eventually one has to stop.
So you're not going to do a sequel?
Oh, well, never say never, but I would love to. As I said, I just did these interviews with cadaver dog teams in California, mm-hmm. and yeah, it's certainly not out of my system yet. I just have so much admiration for working dog teams and all the things that they can do.
Rachel Rose, author of The Dog Lover Unit, you rode along with these canine units, and I'm wondering if you could tell us about one of your most memorable experiences with one of these units.
Oh my gosh, there were so, so many. Well, I think I will talk about the first time that I took a bite from a dog named Cade. That was Daryl Moores, the handler who I was just speaking about. Mm-hmm. So I was not at all prepared. I thought it was something that I do in the future. And he said, no, you can take a bite now. You don't need any preparation on my watch.
And what do you mean by take a bite?
Oh, so they send the dog at you, and you have a bite sleeve, which is a hard jute sleeve, mm. and the dog bites you and holds you.
and so it's an apprehension move.
Yeah, it's an apprehension
okay.
move. Right, so they send the dog. And so I was out there up in near Whistler, B.C., with a bunch of dog teams, and he sent this dog at me. And seeing this big black police dog, you know, just barking and growling and straining to get at me and thinking, what have I done? Why am I here? And then, you know, it was just the most force. And I've done a lot of riding, fallen off horses a number of times. You know, I've been rolled around, stepped on all of that, but just the force of this animal coming at me almost knocked me over. And, you know, I made the mistake of resisting, so he really got me. He was really very, very strong, and it was such an intense thing. And then when Constable Moores called him off, I just had such a flush of adrenaline, and I thought, well, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I can continue. And then he said, hey, you want to try again?
Did you?
I did. Yeah, I did. And it was very interesting. You know, I felt like it had shaken something loose in me that needed to be shaken. And now I call it, you know, like canine therapy, because I tend to be an anxious person, an anxious mom, and just being out there driving at high speeds and actually sort of experiencing some of what people who are being apprehended experience, and just the rough and tumble of it, and actually the real little bit of risk that there is, sort of reset things for me, and in a very interesting way, you know.
Fascinating. Rachel Rose, we are out of time.
Oh.
I want to thank you so much for the time that you've given us here on Real Talk. And Rachel will be here at the Vashon Bookshop Saturday, May 26th, along with another Canadian writer, Gurjinder Basran, who has written about immigration, essentially.
Yes, everything, beautiful books.
Yes, Everything Was Goodbye. So, again, thank you so much. And, folks, if you can get to the Vashon Bookshop on Saturday, May 26th, I think it's going to be really interesting. Thanks for listening. Real Talk is here every Tuesday at noon to answer questions large and small.